2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 234, All Abraham's Children, Changing Mormon Conceptions of Race and Lineage. A panel featuring Dan Smith, Newell G. Bringhurst, Thomas W. Murphy, Morgan Brent Adair, and Armand L. Moss.
Okay, let's get started. I'm pinch hitting really quickly, and then Newell Bringhurst is going to take over when you ask questions. This is session 234, I believe. It's an author meets critic session discussing the book All Abraham's Children, Changing Mormon Conceptions of Race and Lineage by Armand Moss. Armand is here with us, and we also have three great panelists here with us. Yeah, Armand needs to. Well, it's your decision. We'd love to have you up here. I have to mention, it's very important that I mention this book is available for sale down at Benchmark Books. They are at the end of the hall. Benchmark handles Sunstone's book sales, and they do such a tremendous job. They've got a lot of books on this topic. This is the newest and well, certainly one of the most important. Quickly, Newell Bringhurst is the author of Saints, Slaves, and Blacks. He's a longtime friend to Sunstone and a tremendous historian. He's also the author of just the incredible biography of Fawn McKay Brody. And really, along with Armand and Lester Bush, one of the pioneers of helping the church change and overcome its misconceptions towards African Americans. The second person on our panel is Tom Murphy. And because I'm pinch hitting, I'm not going to say enough good things about Tom, but he was, as you may have heard, there was some attention about Tom earlier last year for an article that he wrote on DNA in the Book of Mormon that appeared in American Apocrypha. Tom, also a great friend of Sunstone, and we're very grateful to have him here. His session will be later today, session 251, examining limited geography theories of the Book of Mormon. And our final panelist is Morgan Adair. Morgan is one of the quintessential Sunstoners and a great friend. He is a book collector and an avid reader. He devours everything. And I'm actually part of an email list with Morgan, and he just will post these things, and someone will ask a question and send it by email, and minutes later an email will come from Morgan with the answer. And I know he doesn't have time to go look that up. He's recalling it from memory. And Morgan is going to offer some thoughts on Armand's book as well. And with that, we'll turn the time over to our first speaker.
I worked on revising this up to the last minute, so if it sounds choppy and awkward and disjointed, I want to apologize in advance, because there's a lot to this book, and it really stimulates your thinking in new and different directions. And I have to confess that in my all too brief comments, I just can't begin to do justice to this book. It's Armand's long awaited magnum opus. It's extensively researched, richly multifaceted, and carefully written. You know, that's the first initial impressions you get, and so it aptly reflects Armand's 40-year involvement with the issues of race and ethnicity as they affected Mormonism. In fact, Armand's four-decade odyssey began with two pioneering path-breaking articles published in the mid-1960s, which were amongst the earliest to tackle the highly controversial issue of Mormon attitudes toward African Americans. And that, in turn, was an outgrowth of Armand's doctoral dissertation, Mormonism and Minorities, which was completed at the University of California, Berkeley, in 1970. As for All of Abraham's Children, as I say, it's a meticulous, multifaceted work, not limited to Mormon conceptions of race as they related to African Americans. In fact, Armand devotes just two chapters exploring what he characterizes as the construction and deconstruction of a distinctive racial identity for African Americans, for blacks in general. In fact, more than three quarters of the book some 211 out of its total 277 pages, focuses on issues of identity which involve three other groups, namely the Latter-day Saints themselves, who throughout much of their history identified themselves as the literal descendants of the House of Israel, principally the tribe of Ephraim. The second group that Armin tackles are the American Indians, which were identified by Latter-day Saints as the literal seed of Israel through their descent from Book of Mormon Lamanites. And finally, Jewish people, whom Latter-day Saints embraced as fellow Israelites, whose historical experiences in many ways paralleled those of the Latter-day Saints. Mormon identification with Jewish people were further strengthened by what Armin has characterized as filial Judaic or filial Semitic elements within Mormonism itself. In overall terms, Armin characterizes as a central theme or theory guiding his book the social psychology of identity formation and attribution, involving constructions of an identity for themselves as a people and subsequent related construction of identities for others across the boundaries between them and us. The ongoing process of constructing, deconstructing, reconstructing these collective identities throughout time is one of this work's theoretical underpinnings. Driving this dynamic in turn is a significant sub-theme, which Moss characterizes as the relationship between ideas and organizational change, specifically the dynamic interaction or symbiotic relationship between the church's worldwide proselytizing program and its fundamental theological ideas. So as I say, there's a lot there, and it uses a path-breaking sociological methodology. Now, my comments today will focus primarily on Moss's examination of Mormon perceptions and related treatment of African Americans, which I say is really a minor part or a limited part of the book. And but before I get to that, I just want to acknowledge what a fascinating job he's done in exploring the other three themes. His examination of Mormon self-identity was the basis of his presidential address, which he gave at MHA in 1998, and a longer, fuller version was published in the Journal of Mormon History. So I'm very familiar with that. But the two areas that I was less familiar with when I picked up the book were the areas in which he talks about Mormon identification, dealing with the Indians or the Lamanites, and how that perception has changed over a period of time. I knew a little bit more about that because I'd heard a couple of Armin's papers and some work, the work that Tom Murphy, he's going to get into that a lot more. So I was somewhat familiar with that, but I was much less familiar with Armin's treatment of Jewish identity, Mormon Jewish, the Mormon Jewish aspect. And that part was the most fascinating, the most interesting to me because I knew the less about that, and as I say, I forgot Morgan Adair will be dealing with that. Now, the two chapters that deal with blacks are entitled "The Curse of African Lineage in Mormon History" and "The Campaign to Cast Off the Curse of Cain," which deal with Mormon perceptions before and after 1978, that's of course the crucial turning point. In those two chapters, Moss carefully synthesizes his own research on Mormon black relations with information drawn from the works of other scholars, in particular Lester E. Bush, Jesse L. Embry, Alan Cherry, and incidentally myself. Moss, moreover, carefully and generously acknowledges his debt to all such scholars. I must confess on a personal note that there are clear indications that my Saint Slaves and Blacks, which was published in 1981, was an influence on Moss's first chapter, in which he juxtapositions developing Mormon ethnic self-identity with the later chapters where he talks about negative identification of blacks. I'd like to think that he was influenced by that work. In fact, I can remember a discussion in which we had here at a Sunstone, I think this has been about 10 years ago, and we had argued early on. He had sort of thought that maybe I carried that a little bit too far. And we kind of went back and forth. I've got copies of all those letters. They'll eventually, I guess, go into the Bringhurst archives somewhere. But where we were bantering back and forth, butting heads and everything else. And then one day, and I can remember the exact place. It was just outside the restaurant over here. He says, "You know, Newell, I kind of come around to some of your ideas." I don't know if you recall that or not. Probably not. But and so I guess I was a bit flattered when I heard his presidential address initially, and then when I read the first chapter of his book, and then subsequently the later two chapters. And so as for Moss's own work, he argues and he sagaciously notes that despite the 1978 ban, he starts his the first of the two chapters on blacks with a statement that despite the 1978 revelation ending the ban on black priesthood ordination, quote, "a contradictory and confusing legacy of racist religious folklore hangs like a cloud over LDS relationships with American blacks, even those who have joined the church." As for the restrictive practice itself, Moss states that the origins, correctly states that the origins are obscure, but adding that it almost certainly didn't originate with the founding prophet Joseph Smith. He's very cautious in a lot of his prose. Sometimes I feel like he's maybe too cautious, and I guess that's one of my little nitpicks on that. I think he could be more assertive, because I would be, I strongly believe in my heart of hearts that it didn't start with Joseph Smith. Rather, the policy, as he terms it, was first publicly announced by Smith's successor, Brigham Young, in 1852. In Moss's words, Young made the first formal official statement in Mormon history denying the priesthood to blacks, while at the same time calling for the legalization of black slavery in the Mormon-dominated Utah Territory. He did those things in tandem, together. Moss also carefully chronicles the condition and series of events leading to the 1978 revelation and the lifting of the priesthood ban. With acute insight, the author notes that in retrospect, the 1978 policy change should have been easy to see on the horizon, particularly given various actions taken by LDS church officials during the 1960s and early 1970s, reflecting a new sensitivity to black people. I was among those absolutely surprised, like Armin and like so many other Latter-day Saints. But when you look back in retrospect, you can see things that were happening, which indicates that the church was moving in that direction. And Armin carefully documents those things. A prominent among these was the formation of the Genesis Group in 1971. Suggestions of change, as Armin points out, were even evident in the controversial 1969 official statement by two members of the Church First Presidency, specifically N. Eldon Tanner and Hubie Brown, which on a superficial level, this statement appeared to simply affirm the traditional restriction on the priesthood. But this same statement, as Armin carefully points out, effectively jettisoned almost all of the accumulated scriptural folklore that had been used to justify the policy. In place of all such scriptural claims, The statement simply alluded vaguely to the premortal existence as a possible explanation, but otherwise offered only the simple statement that blacks had been barred from the priesthood, quote, within a quote, for reasons which we believe are known to God, but which he has not made fully known to man, quote, within quote. All such actions notwithstanding, as Armin says, and nearly everybody was caught by surprise by the 1978 announcement. And I even have to put myself in when I wrote my doctoral dissertation, on which became my book. The doctoral dissertation was completed in 75, and my concluding statement in my doctoral dissertation was, based on the above things, I don't see a prospect for change in the near future. Boy, was I wrong. and to give you an idea of that, so I'm a little bit embarrassed, shamefaced about the last chapter of my doctoral dissertation. Those things always come back to haunt you, you know. But the reason that, and then Armin goes on to explain why people were caught by surprise. First, outside criticism and agitation over the priesthood restriction had tapered off by the late 1970s. And secondly, the so-called marginal preliminary measures of the 1960s and 1970s, which he describes, which I mentioned above, were, in Moss's words, didn't appear neither very fundamental or very widely recognized as harbingers of radical change, even among Latter-day Saints themselves. In any event, the delayed timing of the change helped to reassure the faithful, and I guess this in turn, this delayed timing, that they weren't acting under duress or under pressure or whatever, helped to reassure the faithful about the ultimately divine nature of the priesthood change. Armin also provides an excellent overview of black LDS interaction during the 25 years subsequent to 1978. Despite the lifting of the priesthood ban, Moss carefully notes, missionary work among American blacks does not seem to be thriving. Kind of an understatement. Despite a few racially mixed wards and branches, along with some predominantly black ones in Los Angeles and other urban areas, the overwhelming majority of white Mormons rarely encounter blacks at church. And this, in turn, which Moss frankly notes, leads to a certain discomfort and wariness when such encounters do occur. In general, I find Moss's analysis of Mormon perceptions and interactions a richly textured synthesis, despite its relative brevity. But at the same time, I find several aspects of Moss's study wanting. From a historical perspective, Moss is all too brief and somewhat superficial in discussing developments during the late 1840s following the death of Joseph Smith, a time when, in his words, in Moss's own words, was, quote, an especially chaotic period in Mormon history, one that threatened a total fragmentation and disappearance of Mormonism. The result of such fragmentation was the emergence of a number of dissenting Latter-day Saint groups opposed to Brigham Young and his Utah Mormon followers, the two most prominent of these being the so-called Strangites, or followers of James J. Strang, and the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, now known as the Community of Christ, the latter which followed the leadership of Joseph Smith III, the oldest son of the slain Mormon prophet. Both the Strangites and the RLDS allowed for ordination of blacks and strongly opposed black slavery, in contrast to the highly negative attitudes and practices adopted by Brigham Young and his followers. Such conceptions and related practices by these and other Latter-day Saint groups represent forgotten Latter-day Saint alternatives, a term which I used in my very first MHA paper, which Bill Russell and I were on that session together, and that was my essay was later published in Michigan History, in which I dealt with the Strangites and another even more obscure Latter-day Saint splinter group known as the Thompson, the followers of William B. Thompson. And they went off the other deep end. The Thompsonite group, William B. Thompson's group, were even more negative toward blacks than the Utah Latter-day Saints. And so, the Utah Mormons represented somewhere in kind of the center of Latter-day Saintism in this splintering period. But unfortunately, Armin, pardon? No, I think this is a completely different William B. Thompson. Yeah, he was kind of a wild man. He was a whole book could be written about William B. Thompson. But anyway, unfortunately, Armin doesn't cite my Michigan or doesn't utilize, let alone cite either my Michigan history article or even more significant Roger D. Lanius's seminal 1988 work, which deals with the reorganized church, Invisible Saints, a history of black Americans within the RLDS. Also, I find problematic, and I'm getting to the end here, also problematic is Moss's oversimplistic and in some ways misleading discussion of Brigham Young's position relative to black slavery. In the words of Moss, Young, perhaps like Thomas Jefferson, opposed slavery in principle but was willing to tolerate it in Utah temporarily for certain practical reasons. Actually, and being brutally honest here, Young didn't simply tolerate black slavery, but actively embraced it, taking the initiative in calling upon the Utah Territorial Legislature to formally legalize the peculiar institution. This act, in fact, remained in force until 1862, when at long last, in the middle of the Civil War, it remained in force until the middle of the Civil War, until superseded by not Young himself, but by an act of the Congress of the United States, which formally abolished slavery not just in Utah, but all federal territories in the midst of, the gradual movement toward abolition that took place. The next step, of course, was the Emancipation Proclamation and then the 13th Amendment. As for Young, he justified his support for black slavery, as I said earlier, and Moss agrees with this, that black slavery and priesthood denial were kind of in tandem. As for Young, he justified his support for black slavery on deep-seated racist beliefs, affirming the fundamental inferiority of black people and that they were under a divine curse. Also somewhat misleading is Armin's assertion that restrictions on access to the priesthood were not unique to the Mormon Church, wherein he goes on to compare the Mormon ban on black priesthood denial to restrictions placed on African Americans by most theological seminaries of the period. And again, I'm quoting Armin. Since theological schools were gatekeepers to the priesthood, very few blacks got through the gate to ordination except in so-called black churches. Few parishes or congregations or other denominations were any more likely to find black priests or ministers in charge than were black wards within the LDS church. But weakening Moss's own this assertion is Moss's own acknowledgement that the exclusion of black clergy was more conspicuous among the Mormons because of their large voluntary ministry based on a lay priesthood and an otherwise universal male priesthood. This, in Moss's words, he confesses, led to the perception, or created the perception, that this restriction was a uniquely Mormon expression of American racism. Finally, on a stylistic level, I, as I indicated earlier, I do find Armin's prose just a bit turgid, maybe a little bit, as I said, a little bit too tentative in places, and a bit repetitious. And maybe this just reflects my own prejudice and training as a historian rather than a sociologist. Sociologists have a different writing technique, and so this is probably an interdisciplinary quibble which I should have no right to make, but I guess I make it anyway. such problems notwithstanding, I want to end on a positive note because, you know, I really sincerely believe and feel that All of Abraham's Children is an important seminal work, and in many ways the definitive work in dealing with changing Mormon conceptions on race and lineage. Most impressive, I think, is his, I don't know if he'd call it, if he'd agree with this expression, but I find sort of his postmodern multi-ethnic approach, embracing shifting ethnic self-identity, how they perceive themselves, how truth sort of changes with time. These perceptions affecting not just blacks, but other ethnic groups and the dynamics of that, you know, the only other little quibble is, it's not really a quibble, but I guess what it really is that, I think I want to put this in a positive way because I think what it will hopefully do is stimulate similar studies looking at Asians and looking at other ethnic groups like Asians and Middle Eastern Arabs, you know, Middle Eastern Arabs who are identified as the descendants of Abraham through Ishmael. You know, it seems like a real rich exploration could be done in that area. And so, you know, as such, I think that, as I say, Armand's work will serve as an essential starting point for all future scholarship dealing with race and ethnicity as it involves the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Thank you.
I'd like to begin by echoing Newell's assessment that I believe that Armand's book is the authoritative and definitive study of race and lineage in Mormonism. He examines concepts of race and lineage in Mormon beliefs regarding, as Newell has stated, Jews, blacks, and Native Americans. His book is characterized by what he calls three different storylines. And I want to go through and outline those storylines, and then I'm going to focus more specifically on the ones most related to my research, and that's the views on Native Americans. In the first of his three storylines, Armand demonstrates quite compellingly that Mormon conceptions of lineage have fluctuated along with the successes and failures of Mormon missionary work. Using Mormons as a case study, he illustrates a reciprocal relationship between ideas and behaviors on a broad scale, but specifically how the success of Mormon missionary work in particular areas had a direct effect on people's conceptions of lineage, ethnicity, and race. His second storyline, and here I quote, implicates religious ideas in the creation of racial prejudice and invidious ethnic distinctions. And in this respect, he illustrates the complexity of Mormon experience in the context of this larger social phenomenon, that is the interrelationship between conceptions of ethnicity and religion. And of course, this is a difficult story to tell because it doesn't always reflect positively on us as Latter-day Saints. Although Armand is very good at placing Mormon experience within a larger context, repeatedly emphasizing that we live in a racist culture and that Mormons reflect that racist culture. In some ways, I'm not quite satisfied with that explanation. I would like to see us aspire to something better, and I'm sure Armand would like that as well. His third storyline explores the construction and reconstruction of various people's identities. He shows that ethnic, religious, and family identities exist in a cultural context exemplified by negotiations across time and between different peoples. And these three storylines are then characterize the book as a whole. I am most impressed by Moss's overall balance. His ability to address complex and divisive issues in a moderate, yet rigorous and empathetic manner is an example for all scholars of Mormonism. He avoids the polemics that too often characterize discourse by and about Mormons. And in this sense, his book is, again, exemplary. I'd like to focus the remainder of my comments on three particular chapters. And this is chapters 3, 4, and 5. Chapter 3 is called From Lamanites to Indians, 4, Return of the Lamanites, and 5, Old Lamanites, New Lamanites, and the Negotiation of Identity. I'm going to offer an overview of each of these chapters and then a brief critique or challenge that his work poses for us as scholars of Mormonism. Chapter 3, again entitled From Lamanites to Indians, traces the transformation of Mormon views of Native Americans. He shows that early Latter-day Saints held high hopes for the conversion of Indians as Lamanites, or that is, descendants of ancient Israel and the peoples of the Book of Mormon. A century later, though, that initial idealism had given way to what he calls pragmatism. Mormon efforts to evangelize American Indians actually met with what he calls little success, and much resistance, and that often violent. Mormons thus came to view these peoples more as Indians and less as Lamanites, that is, as people of the Book of Mormon. In this respect, Mormon experiences, he argues, were comparable to those of other Christian denominations who also did not meet with lots of success in their attempts to evangelize American Indians. Moss's view and evaluation of the successes of missions reflects, in my opinion, a decidedly Eurocentric understanding of conversion. And he, in this sense, he acknowledges but doesn't fully explore the multiplicity of understandings of conversion experiences. That is, conversion is not always understood in the same way by the convert, or the so-called convert, as by the missionary. And this, as I'll explain in a minute, is dealt with better in another chapter. But in chapter 3, needs further exploration. The American Indians who were baptized as Mormons may not have experienced that baptism in the same way that that was expected by the missionaries. And Moss's book tends to, particularly in this chapter, evaluate the success by those Mormon definitions of conversion rather than by the definitions of conversion held by those people who may have accepted baptism. It's rather well established now in the literature on Christianity and Native American experience that Indians viewed baptism and conversion in clearly different ways than the missionaries. Thus, it was common for Indian converts to be baptized into multiple denominations, and in fact, it still is today. They had to be members of multiple churches and not to see that as a conflict. However, for Mormons, there's only one true church. It's also common for Native Americans to retain their own religious practices, even while participating in aspects of that missionary spirituality or missionary practice. And so that there's, in a sense, an inclusive view of spirituality rather than an exclusive view that tends to characterize Mormonism and many forms of Christianity. And here is where a really interesting part of the story is not told by Armin's book. And, of course, I understand as a scholar that you're never able to tell the whole story. So this is not so much a criticism as a challenge for future scholars. And that is an interesting fact that nearly all the major military foes of Mormons in Utah, and here Wakara and Blackhawk are the most prominent of these, were baptized Mormons. Okay? That is, the enemies of the church, military enemies, were Mormons. And what I really wish had been done, or can maybe should be done in future works, is to view them within that context. That is, accept their self-definition of that status, instead of saying, well, they maybe didn't go to church or didn't pay tithing or didn't go to the temple, although some of them did all of that. Then maybe we could look at 19th century Mormon history in a quite different context, if we could view or try to get a better conception of how Wakara or Blackhawk, for example, viewed their Mormonism. Now, chapter 4 is called The Return of the Lamanites. And this chapter outlines, as the title suggests, the return of the Lamanites to center stage in Mormon eschatology in the mid-20th century. And here, Armin emphasizes the Indian Student Placement Program, renewed missionary work in the mid-20th century, and Indian studies and scholarship programs at BYU. Spencer W. Kimball, he illustrates, was instrumental in this increased focus on Lamanites, and the investment of church resources in Indian programs would follow the rise and then the decline, or the passing of Spencer W. Kimball. So you'd see that this increase of investment corresponds with the increasing influence of Spencer W. Kimball, and then upon his death, a decreasing influence and focus on Indians. And here he shows very interestingly that what I think is one a very fascinating contribution is looking at the embrace initially of the Mormon Indian Student Placement Program and then its abandonment in the latter part of the 20th century. And he argues that this occurred because of the church's understanding of a cost-benefit analysis. That is, again, because of these different understandings of what is conversion and what is success. And here, actually, I should say that in this chapter, Armin does a much better job of acknowledging that there are different definitions of success and conversion. And these differing expectations between the church and the Indians who are participating in the placement program and in the scholarships at BYU, that these differing expectations resulted in the church making a cost-benefit analysis that says that we're not getting the investment that we expect in return, or not getting the return for our investment. That is, the Indians who had been raised in Mormon homes, gone on to BYU, very few of them retained or continued to attend church in the manner that was expected of Latter-day Saints. That is, there was, again, like in the 19th century, not a lot of success with the missionary work if it's defined in the context of are you paying your tithing? Are you attending church on a regular basis? Are you participating in leadership positions in the local congregations? These there were some, again, this chapter does a much better job of addressing those differing expectations of the native converts and the church missionaries and leaders, yet it does pose some challenges as well. One challenge is the connection between the 19th century and this mid-20th century. There's kind of a historical gap that needs more exploration, and that's the early 20th century, the late 19th century, and what's happening with Indians at this time. And particularly, one thing that I guess for personal reasons is intriguing to me is the connection between 19th century adoptions of American Indian children and the placement program, which Armin repeats the common, what I would call a mythology around the Indian placement program, and that's that it began in the mid-20th century, rather than began in the 1840s when Mormons initially brought Indian children into their homes. And just to give an anecdotal reflection on this, the experiences of some of these 19th century children who were adopted into Mormon homes. One example is Penina Shropshire Cottonwood, who is the direct ancestor of my beautiful wife, Carrie. And in her familial experience, we have a strange, phenomenon going on. At the same time that the church is in the mid-20th century and emphasizing this new Lamanite focus, and into the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you continue to see this emphasis. Yet, as Carrie and her sisters were being raised, her mother worked very hard to hide that Indian identity. They were told to cut their hair. The mother was quite concerned when they spent time outdoors, making sure they were covered with ample sunscreen, to ensure that Indianness was not emphasized. And those experiences I would like to see explored more in future work. You know, Armin does not cover in much depth in this chapter. Now, the fifth chapter is titled Old Lamanites, New Lamanites, and Negotiation of Identity. And this is also a very fascinating chapter, as he makes, I think, here probably one of the stronger and almost unexpected arguments for the correlation between missionary work and conceptions of identity. And he shows that, you know, there's 19th and 20th century work with Indians in the United States had met, again, by the church's standards, little success. Yet, in the latter part of the 20th century, there was remarkable proselytizing success in Latin America. And he shows that there's a shift in this emphasis of Lamanites, these old Lamanites of the United States, to the new Lamanites of Latin America. In one sense, it's happening with the missionary work. As the missionary work is successful in Latin America, greater amounts of resources from the church are being invested in that area. But there's also a scholarly refocus. And Armin ties this scholarly refocus to this missionary success. And I find that intriguing, and it may in fact be right, but I wonder, though, to what degree things such as archaeology, the rise of the science of archaeology in the latter part of the 19th century, the dismantling of the mound builder myth, for example, and the implications of that for Book of Mormon geographies, that may have also, along with this missionary work, played an important role in this redefinition of Lamanites from the peoples of the Americas to those of Latin America, or particularly Central America. And that, of course, is exemplified most clearly in the work of the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, or FARMS. And Armin provides an outline of this historical shift. And through this process, Armin, amazingly, avoids debating the historicity of the Book of Mormon, something I've not been able to do. While Armin avoids this debate, he does appropriately warn scholars at FARMS about the danger of claiming a specific and verifiable geography for the Book of Mormon. Now, I will say that as he was working on the final aspects of this manuscript, he had read a copy of my article on DNA, although I had asked him not to cite it. So,
did I cite it?
No. Yeah. Yeah. This afternoon. Well, what are the challenges from the fifth chapter? I would like to see more exploration of how do those who self-identify as Lamanites view this changing focus towards Central America? That is, are those people in North America who have been raised with the idea that they are Lamanites. And now the shifting focus, what's the impact on their understandings of themselves? And that question is not fully explored here. And another question that could be explored in this area is, do Latin Americans understand conversion the same way as North American missionaries? And based upon my work in Guatemala and Mexico, I suspect not. And in fact, David Knowlton will be giving a paper later in the conference addressing some of the discrepancies between Mormon conceptions of conversion as represented in statistics and those self-identification in census figures. In my work in Antigua, Guatemala, I encountered many baptized Mormons who did not self-identify as Mormons, and in fact some who had never been in the church except for once, and that was when they were baptized. And certainly the so-called success includes these figures. And of course, Armin does pay attention to retention as well as conversion, so I don't mean to imply that that's not there. And another anecdotal observation is of differing conceptions of conversion was an interview I had with a former member of the bishopric in Antigua, Guatemala, and he told, well, I had asked him about his church attendance. I was doing this evaluation of various aspects of what it means to be Mormon. One of my questions was, how often do you attend church? And he was quite offended by that question. And he says, my being Mormon has nothing to do with how often I go to church. He says, I do not drink. I do not smoke. I believe in Joseph Smith as a prophet. He says, but the matter of fact is that after I joined the church, my business was very successful. And I attribute this to being a Mormon. He says, well, I ended up buying a pickup, and now I've got so much work, I have to work every Sunday. And, yeah. So, in sum, I highly recommend Armin's book, again, as the authoritative and definitive study of Mormon conceptions of race and lineage. It's carefully researched and well-written. And it's necessary reading for any serious scholar of Mormon studies. I especially appreciate the exploration of the interrelationship between missionary work and conceptions of identity. I appreciate his attention to those who self-identify as Lamanites, though, as I've emphasized, this is an area where greater attention is needed by himself or other scholars. And I also especially appreciate Armin's ability to see Mormons as humans, and the LDS Church as a human institution.
As John mentioned in his introduction, I'm a book collector. I collect what I refer to as scholarly books on Mormonism. My collection includes, I believe, every book published by the University of Illinois Press that has some reference to Mormonism, which is some 79 volumes. On this basis alone, my interest in all Abraham's children should be a no-brainer. As a book, and for a book that deals with religious history, doctrine, and practice, this one's more scholarly than most. I have other books that have statistical analyses of survey data, but this is the first time I've encountered path diagrams outside a computer science or mathematics course. The book's 34-page bibliography illustrates a depth of research and will be a valuable resource to anyone who's interested in the subject of Mormonism and race. I have a general criticism, though, of how Armand references external works. I noticed a number of places in the book where he leaves his readers hanging, as in the following example on page 191. It says, Mormons living in Christian countries have, after all, been exposed to the same religious lore and myths about Jews as have other residents of those countries, illustrated by the recent experience of Keith Norman. Period. Throw your readers a bone here. Most of them don't have a collection of back issues of Dialogue on hand, so you could just say something like, in which a student reported that she'd been taught that the Holocaust was punishment for the Jews' rejection of Christ. That'll save your readers from the feeling that the sentence ended too abruptly.
I cite Norman in 1999, page 168.
Yeah, you do give a reference, but all you have to do is go to the library. Anyway, Dan Witherspoon asked me to focus on the chapters of Armin's book that deal with Mormons' attitudes towards Jews, which should tell you that I got last pick. Mormon teachings and attitudes towards blacks and Native Americans have been more controversial and therefore more interesting. The surveys Armin presents indicate that the feelings of affinity that Mormons traditionally feel towards Jews have resulted in lower rates of religious hostility and secular anti-Semitism as compared with other Christians. One exception to this amiable relationship occurred when it was reported that the LDS Church was vicariously baptizing Holocaust victims. The affinity relationship between Mormons and Jews that Armin describes lies close to the heart of the more difficult relationships that Mormons have had with blacks and Native Americans. Traditional Mormon doctrine claims that both the Jews and the majority of Mormons are literal descendants of Israel. Abortive attempts to evangelize Jews were rationalized on the basis that the time of the Jews had not yet arrived. But as God's chosen people, they still remained in God's favor and the church's. Mormon doctrine also identified Native Americans to be of Israel, but when members of the tribes of North America failed to respond to the Mormon message, while the native peoples of Mexico southward did, leaders of the church stopped referring to North American Indians as Lamanites and began identifying Central and South American natives as being of Israel. The status of black people was more simple. They were simply not of Israel and therefore other. The conclusions that Armin draws from his analysis of surveys raises a question in my mind. On one hand, he concludes that the affinity that Mormons feel for Jews in Mormon doctrine has helped to suppress anti-Semitism, both religious feelings antagonistic towards Jews and secular anti-Semitism among Mormons. One would expect, therefore, on the other hand, that more negative doctrines concerning the eternal status of blacks would result in higher rates of racial prejudice among white Mormons as compared with non-Mormons. But according to the data he presents, the opposite is the case. Are Mormons therefore less prejudiced than other Christians, regardless of what they're taught? With that brief nod to my assigned topic, I would like to now disclose my real agenda, my real interest in Armin's book, which goes beyond merely that of a collector of scholarly books. In addition to our four homemade children, my wife and I have an adopted daughter from China and three recently adopted sons from West Africa. We're concerned that the historical Mormon teachings about race, that the church seems to be following a practice of affecting doctrinal change through silence and denial. For example, a quarter of a century ago, President Kimball identified all the native peoples of North and South America and the islands of the Pacific as descendants of Lehi. Since then, there have been few references in General Conference in the Ensign to natives of Central and South America as Lamanites, but North American Indians have virtually never been identified as Lamanites or of Israel. The idea seems to be that if no one says anything for a generation, everyone will forget that we once believed that North American Indians were Lamanites. Similar situation exists regarding the previous speculative teachings concerning the status of blacks. Although teachings on this subject can still be found in the writings of former church leaders, repudiating these teachings would result in negative publicity for the church. So the safer course is to say nothing or talk as if they'd never existed. For example, in an article in the September 2000 issue of The Ensign, Elder Alexander Morrison said, "How grateful I am that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has from its beginnings stood strongly against racism in any of its malignant manifestations." Now, Elder Morrison knows that what he is saying is not history, but he's not speaking here as a historian, more as a storyteller or a creator of myth. I'm somewhat sympathetic with what he's trying to accomplish. It would be nice to simply say that none of this history ever took place. None of these statements concerning valiance in the preexistence or the curse of Cain and so on were ever made, and just make it all disappear. The problem is that the church has never been successful in ignoring or denying a problem. Official Declaration 2 changed policy and practice, but further proactive steps must be taken to repudiate the still widely held beliefs that were once taught to rationalize the policy of denying the priesthood to blacks. In the first chapter of the book, Armand discusses how Mormon doctrine affected when and where missionary efforts were applied, and conversely, how the missionary experience impacted doctrine. Despite the general attitude of anti-intellectualism that American Mormons share with other Americans, there's been a similar, though less powerful, dynamic between Mormon scholars and church doctrine and practice. William H. Chamberlain, as discussed in a session yesterday, had considerable influence on Mormon attitudes toward evolution and biblical criticism, and particularly on the thinking of B.H. Roberts, John A. Widsoe, and later on Sterling McMurrin. More recent scholars like Hugh Nibley, Sterling McMurrin, Lowell Benyon, and Eugene England have had an impact beyond the intellectual community and on the general church membership. Armand documents how Lester Bush's research on the history of blacks in the priesthood convinced members of the church's governing quorums of the weak historical foundation that this policy was built upon. John Sorensen's writings on geography in the Book of Mormon led to a revision of teachings concerning the identity of the Book of Mormon peoples. It's my hope that Armand's book will open a discussion on the subject of race in the church so that we continue the progress that began with the priesthood revelation 25 years ago. Thank you.
Well, I'm deeply grateful to my colleagues for the generous remarks that they've made on my work, and I really have very little to take exception to. I think virtually all the criticisms that they made are warranted, and my response would simply take the form of saying, well, thanks for that. When I revise it, I'm sure going to take all that into account. I think all authors have the experience of reflecting on their criticisms by saying, you know, that's right. That should have been in there. So I do appreciate that. But before I forget, I have to say something that arises out of my own disciplinary, scholarly compulsion that has almost nothing to do with anything any of these colleagues said, except the passing reference to the statistical part of my book. Once I got it all done and I got my first copy, I realized that from the beginning that anything that was the least bit acute or complex by way of statistical presentations would have to be in an appendix. I mean, nobody was going to read that in a regular chapter. So I understood that and appreciated it. So I put four important statistical diagrams, path diagrams, in an appendix, Appendix C. And I'm just going to forewarn everybody, if anybody is a statistics buff, I don't want you to leave without knowing this. Well, among these four path diagrams in Appendix C, which I refer to in the text, you know, for anybody who wants to look them up and whose eyes won't glaze over when they see them, somehow, after the final copy of everything left my hands, the printer succeeded in switching two of those diagrams so that what shows as diagram C1 should be C4 and vice versa. 2 and 3 are okay. Now, I don't think anybody here has noticed that. And fortunately, probably very few will. But in case there is a sociologist here, I don't want him to think that after 40 years of work in the discipline that I would make a mistake like that. If you get your copy of the book, the titles of the figures are correct. C1 is, you know, is supposed to be what it says C1 is supposed to be. But the diagram itself, you have to move from C4 up there to get it in the right place. That was kind of a shock, but in general, I'm very pleased with the work that the press did. It's a great outfit to work with. What Morgan just said, I think I need to correct just a little bit. As I recall, the overall impact of my surveys comparing Mormon attitudes toward Jews with Mormon attitudes towards blacks, what I think they say is that Mormon attitudes toward blacks did show evidence of LDS doctrine about blacks in the beginning, since on almost all race issues and related social issues, actually, even in the 1960s, Mormons were from the center to the liberal part of the spectrum. But when it came to blacks, Mormons were right in the center on civil rights issues. Some denominations were more conservative than Mormons, some were less. But when the revelation of 78 came, and you began to then compare Mormon survey data with survey data of other religions, you see a steady movement of the Mormon figures to the liberal side of the continuum. And so that leads to the inference, certainly, that the early doctrines about blacks and the priesthood prohibition for a long time suppressed what would have been a more natural and normal Mormon proclivity toward egalitarianism in racial matters. And whereas the teachings about the Jews were the opposite, they were pro-Semitic. And as you might expect, from the beginning showed a special feeling of affiliation with Jews. I do think that what I had to say about the Jews is probably not well known at all outside of people who are especially interested in the subject. And I learned a lot in the beginning of my research on this from Stephen Epperson's book on Mormons and Jews. And if any of you haven't seen that, you should read it. After reading that and reading some of the critiques of Epperson, and then reading some of the archival material on missionary efforts to Jews in the 20th century, I came to a conclusion that I think would be rather interesting for Latter-day Saints, and I recommend this thought to you as you all go out and read the book and look at those chapters on Jews, and that is the idea that whereas Mormons have been kind of universal in their efforts at proselyting, that is, until certainly after 1978, including Africa, that is, have felt that Mormon leaders and missionaries came to feel increasingly with the passage of time that all peoples in the world are fair game for proselyting. With the Jews, there's continued to be a reluctance about that. And it goes back to some things that Epperson and others have explained, and Arnold Green too, about the way, about controversies between Joseph Smith and his earliest followers about what the status of the Jews and their future was in the eyes of God, whether it was up to the Mormons to convert them or for it to be done some other way in God's own due time. It's remarkable that when Orson Hyde and others went to the Holy Land to dedicate it, they didn't dedicate it for the conversion of the Jews. They didn't even dedicate it for preaching of the gospel to the Jews. They dedicated it for the return of the Jews to Jerusalem. And so there's been this kind of reluctance to take on Jewish conversion. There were three different attempts made in the 20th century to convert Jews, and every one of them would, I think, by any objective measure, be called a debacle. There may be some spiritual benefits that arose from among the parties that participated, but on the whole, there was never much success with conversion. One mission president in the East, New York area, that had missionaries out working among the Jews, in fact, organized special districts of the mission. They weren't geographic districts. They were kind of, well, districts where were known to be heavy Jewish residential areas were created as special districts for missionaries to go out and work. And the mission president reports in his diary about this that he couldn't assign missionaries to those districts for more than 6 months because it was such a demoralizing experience. So it's been tough. Not that the Jews were hostile in any way. They just would listen as good open-minded people to what the missionaries said the first time, but they didn't want a second one. And it was just terrific resistance. But you see this ambivalence among the early Latter-day Saints and contemporary Latter-day Saints all the way along, ambivalence about how to deal with the Jews. It's almost as though you get the sense from Joseph Smith's teachings in the 1840s as opposed to 1830s, a sense that the Lord and the Jews, they have a side deal, you know. And the Mormons are supposed to go ahead and work on everybody else. But the Lord's going to take care of the Jews in his own time and his own way. And so pretty much Mormons have, you know, backed off. And I have some stuff in my book about, relationships over the Jerusalem Center, BYU Jerusalem Center, and a lot of other things. And you see a much more focus in recent years in trying to see what can be done with Palestinian Christians than with Jews. I think about the only thing I would like to take some exception to with where Newell's comments are concerned is something that will probably require more time to discuss than we have here. There's no question. And this has to do with Brigham Young's attitudes on race. There's no question that Brigham Young was a racist by any modern understanding of that term. But I don't think it makes any sense to single him out as a racist. What you do I think historians need to avoid the fallacy of presentism, reflecting back on the earlier times and applying our own standards. I do think that when you read Abraham Lincoln, especially in the Douglas debates, when you read other contemporaries of Brigham Young, you find there was a range, and within that range there were some a little more racist than others, but that was a range of racism. And it comprised nearly the entire white American population. Hardly anybody certainly not either Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln ever believed that whites, well, that blacks were the social equals of whites, or should be the social equals of whites. So, you know, everybody in the 1840s and 1850s believed that blacks were inferior, and to the extent that they brought in religious arguments, they believed that blacks were descendants of Cain or Ham or both. Everybody believed that. So finding that, and even Joseph Smith believed that. He said so. By way of a kind of what he thought was a generous comment about blacks. Joseph Smith, remember, in kind of a well-known saying that if the descendants of Cain had had all the opportunities of the rest of us, they'd be just as good as we are. That, you know, take into account their environmental restrictions. That wasn't his phrase. But then, you know, we would all be affected adversely the way they have been. But he just refers to them in passing as descendants of Cain, because even when he was trying to be generous, and because that's what everybody believed. Now, a belief in the descendants of Cain doesn't necessarily get you to a support of slavery. Because almost everybody who opposed slavery even believed the blacks were descendants of Cain or Ham or both. So I think it's probably going too far, and the reason I hesitated to go that far, Newell, I think it's going too far to say that Brigham Young was a proponent of slavery. I think Brigham Young had the sense, this was, now we're talking about the 1852. Remember, at this time, slavery was still permissible in a number of states of the Union. There was no federal law against slavery. And what I read Brigham Young as saying is that since slavery is permissible in some other states, we ought to let it be permissible here for those who have slaves. It wasn't a call to promote slavery so much as it was a call to make the environment permissive in Utah for slaves, because there was a relatively small number of white southern converts that had slaves. So I think if you read Brigham Young's comments altogether out of the Journal of Discourses and everywhere else, and get a kind of fuller picture of what form his racism took, I don't think that you can make the case that he was an enthusiast or a promoter of slavery in the sense that we would have expected a Southerner to be. But he certainly accepted it as something that Utah should permit. But the other thing we got to remember is that in that same session of the legislature that passed permissive legislation for slavery, for black slavery in Utah, they passed permissive legislation for Indian slavery in Utah. And the motivation for that was altogether different. It was to try to interfere with slave trading going on among the Indians and between the Indians and the Mexicans. That was where, as Tom says, the adoption of Indian children began in Mormon families. I think the slavery, the whole slavery thing is quite complex, and so I'm reluctant to go as far as Newell did. But I think otherwise I have very little else that I would say in defense of my work, and I do appreciate the time and attention that everybody's given to it. Thank you.
We've got about 15 minutes for questions. I just want to rebuttal about one sentence or so. I can't let that go and respond. I think the bottom line is if you compare Brigham Young with Joseph Smith, particularly Joseph Smith's 1844 campaign, where Joseph Smith is unequivocally calling for the abolition of slavery, a position which he gradually moved toward during the 1840s. I think Brigham Young's pro-slavery position stands in stark contrast. It's true that he tried to backpedal a little bit, he tried to waffle a little bit. I mean, there are statements where he says, I wouldn't endorse slavery for myself, but this legislation will allow it for those slaveholders who have brought slaves to Utah. He said it was like a local option where slavery was unequivocally legalized in Utah. I think Armin would agree with that, and to me that's the bottom line, whereas I think Joseph Smith would have been rolling in his grave. I mean, I really do. Seeing how Brigham had reversed his position, and what the reorganized church did, you know, is more carrying on in the tradition of Joseph the Martyr. You know, what when Joseph III expressed his strong, unequivocal opposition to slavery. But that's all I'm going to say there. I want to open it up for questions. And could you please come to the microphone and maybe identify yourself and say who you'd like to direct the question to, or you can just make a comment, too.
My comment is to Armin, and my name is Steve Oakey. Part of the corollary with the whole acceptance of Jews is the implicit acceptance of the State of Israel and the support of the State of Israel by the general body of Mormons. And in spite of the fact of the dedication of the return of the Jews to that land, I believe it was Nephi in the Book of Mormon who said that the Jews would not return to land until and unless they accept Jesus as the Christ. Could you please comment on that?
On the State of Israel, I think it's important to point out that beginning at least as early as the administration of Howard W. Hunter, if not sooner, official statements appearing in the Ensign make explicit that the church does not take sides in the Arab-Israeli dispute. Now, I think a lot of Latter-day Saints, like a lot of evangelical Christians, are certainly pro-Israel for reasons that are partly religious and partly maybe political. But my reading of the historical record is that for about the last 30 years at least, the LDS Church has tried to back away from an official favoring of the claims of Israel against the Palestinians. That's different from how you feel about Jews. I mean, the State of Israel is one thing, and Jews is something else again, and I think we have to keep that distinction. And in fact, Bonner Ritchie, among others, who is here, could tell us a lot about LDS official and unofficial efforts really on behalf of improving the lot of the Palestinian people. So I think there is a more of an even-handedness that we see in recent decades on the Israeli dispute. Certainly the Book of Mormon reflects comments about Jews in the Book of Mormon, which were the comments that Joseph Smith initially understood to be the correct view on Jews, were that's Joseph Smith's understanding that we see from the pages of the Book of Mormon was modified as time went on, and Joseph Smith looked differently on the Jews after he went through what Jan Shipps calls his Hebraicizing period in the late 1830s and 1840s. So whatever the Book of Mormon says about Jews doesn't necessarily sum up the view that Joseph Smith had about Jews by the time he died. And don't forget that there's a lot of there are a lot of other things in the Book of Mormon. You know, like you remember that stirring passage, a Bible, we got a Bible, and but what thanks do they give to those who gave us the Bible? And so there's certainly a an opening toward Jews in the Book of Mormon, but it becomes more pronounced, I think, during Joseph Smith's later life. It's my best comment. Well, since I mentioned Bonner Ritchie, I guess we have to let him say something.
Thanks, Norman. I love your book, and I agree with your position. Let me suggest two or three dimensions, one of which is language. I'm very troubled and intrigued at the impact of language. The use of the term Zion and Israel in Mormon discourse, in our hymns, in the scriptures, in our language, creates an enormous bias, I think. I think that the language factor is a really significant issue. And it's really interesting when you go to church in Saudi Arabia or Jordan or Damascus or Cairo. Those words are very loaded words. And as I picked up in a Muslim woman who's coming to BYU to school, and I had on my seat educating Zion as a text that the BYU administrators were using. Very offended and very troubled by the use of those words. And we use those words without thinking about the contemporary political impact and what they do in terms of biasing our perspective about that part of the world. And so I think we are supporters inadvertently. But let me back up to another point. I was a missionary in New York during the 50s in those Jewish enclaves, and they weren't neutral, Armin. They were nasty. The data in the Mission President's Journal is sanitized for political correctness purposes, I suspect. But it was a very nasty world, and remains so. There's a kind of intellectual excitement in Jewish culture that I thrive on, that I love. I love the discourse in the yeshivas in Jerusalem, but that quickly turns the other way as I walk into the BYU Jerusalem Center and I'm pelted with rotten food and dirty diapers as a statement of the tolerance for other points of view, for Mormon values in that world. And not just directed against us, but directed against women who try and pray at the wall. And the organized efforts on the part of rabbinical students in Jerusalem is really interesting. Now, that's contrasted to people like Rabbi Hartman in Jerusalem, who says his job is to save the Bible from the Jews and the Jews from the Bible, indicating that legacy of tradition, the law of the ancient law, and the use of that today to justify behavior is very inappropriate, and the good parts of the Bible, the Old Testament, the Torah, ought to be preserved for mankind, independent of Joshua's rantings about killing everybody. And so it's kind of a dialectic. It's a fun debate. It's a fun issue. And so there is no Jewish position. There's an ultra-Orthodox Jewish position. There's a Zionist position. And there's a conservative and reformed and very different Jewish position that I think we ought to be aware of. But our language is very biasing in that history. One more variable. We also I think we do cut slack for Jews. I think God does have a side deal with them in that philosophical position. But also with Muslims. We also have that same kind of hesitancy and that same uncertainty and that same concern over what do we do in that world? What do we do to articulate a reasonable position in that relationship? And so we have reached out through the humanitarian rather than the religious, rather than the missionary arena. And it's very aggressive and very effective in doing a lot of things. But much more respect, much more response, much more openness in the Muslim world of the Middle East than in the Jewish world is still, in at least the Zionist world, is still a really difficult process.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Appreciate that expansion. I think the young man in the yellow shirt is next. I'm sorry, I guess I've taken over.
Yeah,
your
go
role.
Ahead. Sorry. Yeah, you go ahead. Good. You can do that. It's your book. And go ahead.
Yeah.
Young man, thanks. I guess I have one comment and then one question. My comment was that there were New England abolitionists in New England who thought of blacks as their moral equivalent and not less than human. So there were whites in New England in particular who thought that blacks were every bit as equal as they were. My question is, since 1978, why hasn't the church disavowed some of the myths that were associated with the reasons for the ban on the priesthood, which I think Lester Bush adequately did in his article? And my question, I guess, is to anyone on the panel.
Go ahead.
Okay. In all immodesty, I must say I think I answered that question in Chapter 9. So if you get a chance to read it, it basically boils down to the importance for the LDS for the Latter-day Saints as an organization, particularly for the public relations enterprise in the church. It's important to maintain certain organizational myths that we have. And one of those organizational myths is that everything is moving along in a progressive direction, getting better and better there, and it's all a straight line toward perfection. There are no zigs or zags. There's no going back. Everything always goes in the same direction. You notice when the 1978 announcement was made about giving the priesthood to blacks, it was accompanied by a statement that as early presidents of the church always anticipated, the time would soon come when the blacks would be given the priesthood. Well, some early presidents did and some early presidents didn't. But that was kind of the line. And related to that is another myth I take up, which I call the myth of time-filtered history, the idea that we're not only all moving along in continuity here, but that with the passage of time, we forget the things that are ugly and negative. And actually, we should. The best way to understand history is without all of the skeletons in the closets and all of that. Because what's the point of harping on it? You can't help it. You can't do anything about it. It's just there. And so let's all just look to the future. And you see this viewpoint personified in everything President Hinckley says. He's really a personification of this, and I think that's where the reluctance comes from. In a book by Richard and Osling and
Osling.
Yeah, but what's
Joan?
Thank you, Osling. In a book by Richard and Joan Osling, there is an account. I just happen to remember the page numbers 103 to 06. In which they go through an explanation of an attempt that was made at the general authority level to get a public repudiation of the old folklore and stuff. It never quite got to the first presidency before a leak to the press screwed the whole thing. There are certainly among the leaders of the church those who see the necessity for coming out with some kind of public statement, not necessarily an apology, but just a repudiation of the accumulated folklore about marks and curses and blackness and preexistence and all that stuff. And it's just such an irony that hangs around after the supposed reason for it, to explain the priesthood ban, has long since disappeared. So, okay.
You got time for me? One more question, I think. We're getting close to
okay.
The end. Yeah.
My name is Jerry Van Beek, and I have heard very little about the lineage of Ismail. The question is why, and to support this, on top of the new conference center, it's a beautiful picture, sandblasted in granite.